This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. It is not intended to cause or induce breach of an existing agency agreement.
Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver
Commercial
Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to the Vancouver Commercial Real Estate Podcast. I'm Corey Wright.
And I'm Melissa Moretti.
And Melissa, we have a spectacular show today. It was a tremendous episode. People are going to love this one. Lots of great insight. We have Brad Jones, Senior Vice President of Development for West Group and a recent 40 Under 40 winner from Business in Vancouver.
Oh, wow.
We're super lucky to
know that. That's incredible.
Yeah. No, great episode. People are going to love it. We dig into DCCs and CACs and we talk about affordability issues and some amazing projects they have coming up. Tons of fun. But tell me, how busy is the real estate market right now? Because I'm hearing a lot of things. Like it's like multiple offer season out there.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. You know what? You're probably hearing conflicting information because it feels that way a little bit every day, right? Every day feels a little bit different. I would say, you know, if you look at the stats, inventory is up quite a bit.
Yeah.
But from being down on the ground and working with buyers, I still have a lot of buyers looking. So
are they hesitant to buy? That's why they're still looking? Or is it just like the product they want is selling so fast?
No, I mean, I have a lot of active buyers, I guess I should say.
Yeah.
But
or maybe is it the agent that just can't close a deal?
Oh, not the truth.
That's not the problem. Okay.
Well, got that off the table. The nice thing is that they've got lots to look at, right?
Yeah.
Which is, it's so different than what we've seen in the past couple of years and in a lot of times in the market, right? So it's good to be able to look around, you know, take your time. And that's, there's not a lot of pressure, I don't think, for buyers right now.
Is the sell-through of the new inventory happening or is it just kind of like inventory stacking on inventory right now?
It's just, you know, there's been a bit of an influx this spring, but
time of year.
Yeah.
Happens.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I haven't seen you because last week and the week before that you weren't here.
That's right. You had Adam.
Yeah, that's right.
And then you had Matt.
And we had Matt and I haven't seen you since the life-changing experience that we had
some,
at BC Place.
That's right. You've had a couple of really exciting things. I can see in your face. You look like a very excited puppy dog right now.
Oh,
you want to tell me all about it.
Oh, I wanted to tell you because before we hit record and we had Brad join us, I started talking to you about Nickelback and then you just conveniently walked out of the room unannounced
that's
and didn't
right.
come back until we were recording.
That's right.
I felt because you wanted to ignore my conversation about Nickelback.
I just had to let you cool down, you know, bring it down a notch.
Yeah. Well, you were very quick to point out that I was promoting our ticket giveaway as a Nickelback concert at BC Place. But you were quick to point out it was a country festival. They just happened to be there. People aren't filling BC Place because of them. So you were very quick to point that out. So for all those listeners, it was a country festival.
That's right.
That Nickelback
played at.
No, not played. Headlined.
Okay. So how was it?
Oh, it was amazing. The concert was on Friday. I felt like I was hungover to the following Wednesday. And the sad part is I didn't really have that much to drink, but I felt like I was hungover for the thing. And then at the end of the night, how much do you think 12 cookies? This just goes to speak when you've had, although maybe you've had your fair share of drinks, 12 cookies. So I love my chocolate chip cookies and ice cream. I will eat it 24/7 if I can. And my waistline shows it. That's why my Peloton's always broken.
Okay.
So at the end of the night, Nickelback is almost done. And you're kind of like, you know what? I could really go for some chocolate chip cookies.
12 of them.
12 of them.
No.
What do you think 12 cookies, 12 chocolate chip cookies cost at BC Place in a box? I'll say we're in a box.
You're in a box.
So you're going to pay more right there. So what did 12 cookies cost at BC Place in a box?
I'm going to say $57.
So the number I'm going to give you, you have to add 12% tax on that and a 20% gratuity. So we're adding 32% to this number, $95.
Ooh.
$95. So I conveniently leave the box. I'm thinking that's a lot of money. So I'm filling my pockets full of all the cookies that I just paid for. And I go back to my hotel. I'm exhausted. It's like 11:30 right now. I can't go anymore. This is past my bedtime. I wake up the next morning And I forgot all about the cookies. And I go put my hands into my into my jacket pocket. Sure enough, chocolate chip cookies melted.
You did not.
Yeah, the chocolate like melted in my pocket. So I put my hand into a mush of $95 chocolate chip cookie dough at that point. But as we all know, after you've had a great night before, what do? I take it out, I eat it.
You ate them.
I ate it. I was like hungry.
Right? I would have done the same.
I was hungry. Truthfully. So I was very excited to find out that I had not only one pocket full of chocolate chip cookie dough, but I had two pockets full of chocolate chip cookie dough.
Wow. What a treat.
It was amazing. It was like I did.
You had a great night.
Great night. Cookie dough for breakfast.
That's right.
It was just awesome.
Awesome. Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it.
It was amazing. I just felt like I wanted to tell you that. You wouldn't let me tell you before, but because we're recording right now, you can't look like a you know what on the microphone.
That's right.
I could share my thoughts with you now. You look so unimpressed and you look like you're bored, but I wanted to share my thoughts with you.
All right. Well, the listeners are happy. I'm sure. Happy to hear it.
So without further ado, let's get to our interview with Brad Jones, Senior Vice President of West Group Development.
All right, let's go.
This podcast is presented by Impact Commercial.
Impact Commercial, John, Alan, the team over there are fantastic. They've all been on the show.
They have, yeah.
Friends of the show.
Great guys.
Wealth of experience. They can help with all your commercial financing needs.
Whether it's owner-occupiers, land development funds, commercial investments, or multifamily, these guys got you covered.
And they recently obtained their CMHC correspondent lender status.
So for all your commercial lending needs, visit them at impactcommercial.ca.
That's impactcommercial.ca.
Attention realtors, homebuyers, and investors. If you missed out on Atlin at Clayton Crest by Zentera Developments, here's your second chance.
Atlin sold 80% in just 3 months, Adam. And because of that success, Zentera is launching Building 2, Butte.
Located in West Clayton and walking distance to the future SkyTrain station, prices are still low for now, but not for long.
Homeowners across the Lower Mainland are using equity from their current homes to invest in West Clayton, ahead of the SkyTrain and the next market upswing, because when that SkyTrain is complete and the market rebounds, it'll be too late.
This, Matt, is how wealth is built. Find out why Atlin sold so fast and register now at buttecondos.ca. That's B-U-T-E condos.ca.
All right, we're here today with Brad Jones, Senior Vice President of Development for West Group. Brad, how are you doing?
I'm great. How are you guys doing?
Good. Thanks so much for taking your time out of your busy day today. And for our listeners that have listened to you on the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast, Matt and I have had you on before, we wanted to bring you on today to tell us more about some of the costs associated with development, mainly the new announced ACCs that are coming out. But before we get into that, can you tell us more about yourself and how did you end up at West Group in the position that you're in?
Yeah, sounds good. I've been at West Group 9 years now, actually, which seems like a long time. So I came over to West Group. I was at Adira Development before that for 5 years. Came over to West Group out of a big interest in the work in master plans and kind of taking on the lead of the River Districts, which is our big 130-acre master plan in Vancouver. I have a background in urban planning, so it was a nice opportunity to mix that with liking doing real estate developments and have just kind of grown with the company since then. And we continue to have a big focus on master plans with a few others on the go, you know, Port Moody, Surrey, New Westminster as well now.
Yeah, I noticed the Inlet District signs are up now in Port Moody there. So we'll maybe touch on that one. I think that will be a tremendous, I'm in the Burke Mountain area, not too far from there. So I drive by it quite often. So I think it's a much needed project for that area, no question. For all of our listeners too, we'll be very familiar with West Group. And obviously you guys are tremendous and massive home builders here in the province. What we wanted to kind of dig in today a little bit was our listeners may or may not know a whole bunch of costs that get associated with the development thing. Prior to this, most commonly people would hear things like DCCs and CACs. Recently announced is a potential new cost associated, which would be ACCs. But before we get to ACCs, Brad, can you tell the listeners more about what DCCs and CACs are and how they're collected and where they go?
Yeah, for sure. So DCCs, development cost charges, sometimes called development cost levies, those are fees and charges traditionally related to infrastructure associated with construction. So think sewers, you know, sometimes it includes schools, parkland, but primarily, you know, water and sewer infrastructure, roads, that type of thing. So hard infrastructure required based on the impact of the development. The thing that most people don't realize that aren't in the industry is while a project pays that, it also is probably doing all the roadworks around the project. So that developer is actually taking on the work of putting in the sewers, putting in the water upgrades, putting in new hydrants, street lights, trees, sidewalks, bike lanes, all of that around the project on top of paying that DCC fee. So that's something not a lot of people realize. And then on the other side, CACs, community amenity contributions. So that's the kind of broader impact of the development, you know, libraries, community centers, rec centers, things like that. And over the last, you know, call it decade and a half, those have really taken off. And as the industry was growing and booming and projects were selling out and getting bigger, the share of the cost of the project that went into the CAC bucket kept getting larger and larger until we've really found the point that equilibrium has been broken. And we're seeing these CACs, projects don't have the capacity to pay them anymore. Some of them are negotiated. That's starting to go away. Very few cities do the hardcore negotiated approach outside of the city of Vancouver. In some cases, many are moving to fixed rates, which is what the province recommends. But the challenge being the economics of most projects now can't pay the fixed rate CACs at all as a result of other fee increases. The biggest one and most recent one being the Metro Vancouver DCC increase, which can cost, you know, I think around $20,000 a unit. And so it's really changing the paradigm of ability for projects to pay. And we have these multiple levels of government fighting for a declining share of the pie.
So if I'm a future homeowner buying into a new construction project, the developers paying these DCCs and CAC fees currently, those costs are definitely contributing to the overall cost of the project, which thus probably end up on the purchaser's plate when you're paying $1,000, $1,200, $1,500 a foot for a new potential condo or a project or townhouse because of these costs that are being levied by these local municipalities and provincial groups.
Absolutely. So right now, today in the city of Vancouver, if you buy a two-bedroom apartment,
yep,
30% of the price of your home is government fees and charges. So, you know, 900 square foot, two beds, sells for, call it $1.2 million. You're paying $350,000 in direct government fees and charges as part of that purchase price. There's a fallacy in land economics that doesn't really work in the Lower Mainland. And people say always, well, it just comes out of the land. So the developer takes it out of the purchase price of the land. What that theory misses is that there's often other uses that are next down the value chain for the price of that land. So one of the hardest things to beat out the value of in land development is just the value of a single family home. We talked about our Inlet District project in Port Moody. One of the things we really struggled with in that project was actually getting the economics to work to the point that we could pay really above market single family home prices for those 59 single family homes. And there were many points of the project where the amenity asks of the city were taking it to the place that the lots were more valuable as single family homes than they were worth as a master plan mixed use development across the street from a SkyTrain station.
Yeah, no kidding, eh? So from a listener's perspective, you mean the challenge is my single family house potentially is worth $2 million. And if you want me to sell to you as a developer, as an assembly group, the pitch to us, typically coming from maybe a real estate agent who's trying to inform the sellers of the value of their land, is instead of me getting $2 million for my house potentially as a single family home to a new single family home buyer, that collectively, if we assemble, we might get paid 20% or 25% or whatever that number looks like above market value because of the future density that the developer can bring in. But with what you're saying is because of all these potential costs that are coming on to the developer now, that lot might be worth more as a single family house than as an assembly to a developer, which can create more housing. And in this case, next to a SkyTrain.
Exactly. So what it's doing is it's making projects harder to get off the ground, harder to finance. They require more equity. And there's not a whole bunch more capital coming into the housing market right now because the returns aren't there. And
yeah.
Capital seeks returns. So, you know, the big pension funds, the REITs, et cetera, aren't investing in housing as much because you can go to your bank and get a savings rate for nearly what you get on it as an annualized return on a project.
Yeah.
So housing's just not an attractive investment anymore. And projects are just going to sit on the shelf because you can't make that competition work to take the land down.
So to make things even more unaffordable now, we've come out and we've talked about a new potential charge to be passed on, which are ACCs. And I know the regulations haven't been set in stone just yet, but what are ACCs?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think we're all still trying to figure that out. So the ACCs fell out of the big housing policy changes that came out of the NDP government in November. And so it kind of fell into three buckets, you know, residential small lot development, development finance, where ACCs fell under, and then the transit-oriented development policy, which has probably got the most attention. So in the development finance piece of this, they've made a few changes. I'll actually touch on what they changed in DCCs first.
Yeah, please.
That's not getting a ton of attention, but they've actually expanded what can be captured in DCCs. And so I think we're going to see those go up fairly substantially as well based on this expansion. So it now includes a broader allowance to charge out highway construction and, you know, new interchanges and things like that. I'm not sure, you know, the scope of that. I don't think anyone is. So I'm not sure what the impact of that's going to be. But it also now includes the cost and capital for, you know, fire halls, police stations, and garbage and recycling facilities.
Okay.
So they've expanded what's able to be captured in DCCs. So naturally, we're going to see those go up based on the new policy. And then the ACCs, I was quite excited, to be honest, when the announcements came out, that this was going to be the CAC reform the industry's been talking about for a long time. And since that time, I think it's been kind of whittled away. So ACCs are amenity cost charges. And similar to CACs, really a tool to collect funds for amenities to support, you know, the impacts of new development, people, kids, et cetera. So community centers, libraries, daycares, senior centers, rec facilities, public squares, that type of stuff. And the thing that I think is good about it is that it spreads it out more. So rather than it just being on large projects and big rezonings, it applies across really all development. So it's collected at building permit or subdivision. And so it's required on the entirety of really the development landscape. So it's spreading it around whether a project's going under existing zoning or new zoning. It's a bigger pool to fund these things from. So I think big picture, that's probably a more equitable approach. But it's not having the impact I thought it would have. So the province has come out and has made it quite clear that municipalities can continue to charge CACs on top of that. So we potentially have this structure now where you're paying more in DCCs, more in the Metro Vancouver DCCs, more for your TransLink DCCs, more in public art, more in property transfer tax, all of these things, on top of now having the ACC, and then on top of the ACC, having a further CAC or density bonus framework. So it's quite confusing how this is all going to land right now. And many of the municipalities are struggling with how to structure this and figure it out.
So when you're looking at it from when the local municipalities are screaming at unaffordability issues in the housing market there, they should almost be looking in the mirror is what we're kind of getting to with all these costs. And it seems like this is, you know, maybe a very archaic way potentially of doing it. Is there a better way that, whether it be from a federal level or a provincial level or a municipal level, that we could look at trying to capture these costs, but in a better way and maybe not levying the homeowner, the developer, thus the homeowner, through all these, you know, acronyms?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I think that every level of government needs to stop and have a look in the mirror at the housing crisis across the country right now. There's a great study from a group out of Ontario, the Canadian Center for Economic Analysis, that found that new housing construction is the highest tax industry in the entire Canadian economy at around 30% of value. It's higher than we tax cigarettes for. And excise taxes exist to try to get people to stop doing things. And so we're in the midst of a housing crisis and we're taxing housing at the highest rate of any sector of the economy. it's mind-boggling when you step back and think about it. It's like taxing food during a famine.
No kidding.
And so we've just created this environment where it's kind of impossible to move. I mean, there's a lot of real estate developers in the country that are struggling to get projects off the ground. The City of Toronto is having its, you know, slowest sales performance to start a year, in decades. And all that means is that as we have, you know, this massive immigration over the last few years, housing starts are declining. And our problem's about to get a lot worse because it takes a long time to convert a start to a completion in today's construction environment. And so we haven't even seen the beginnings of the next few years of the housing crisis as a result of starts falling because the economics don't work. And to your question, yeah, I think it's time for a new way of really funding growth, really in the major markets of Canada, because the majority of population growth moves to a few markets in the country. They face the most growth pressure. And yet the only way we deliver infrastructure is effectively by home buyers paying 30% tax on their purchases. And don't forget, even in a rental development, those same charges get paid. And so that gets factored into rent as well, because if the project doesn't work, it doesn't get built. So I think we're at a place where levels of government really need to start looking at the way that we're funding these things. There should be a broader infrastructure bank for this type of work. I think the feds need to play a much, much larger role in this. If a major part of our economic strategy is population growth requires housing and housing requires infrastructure. As the long-term beneficiary of population growth, the feds should be making those major investments in infrastructure and making sure that we have an environment that we can build housing in and communities that have, you know, appropriate infrastructure and appropriate amenities so that people can take their kids to swimming lessons and to the rec center and things like that. I mean, there's lots of people that live in the City of Vancouver right now that go to Richmond and Burnaby and North Van to get their kids into rec centers for swimming lessons. And so I think we're finding the place where the model's probably been broken for a little while and it was being saved by the market. And it's evident that it's not working now.
Is there a way, do you see in the future, that maybe looking to put this into a federal level? Like, is there lobbyists out there that are trying to push this more into a federal level with them being the beneficiaries, like through income tax and stuff like that? Is that getting traction at all?
The conversation's starting and we're starting to see it. You know, there's folks like Mike Moffitt, who's a housing advocate out of Ontario, that's starting to talk about the infrastructure funding model and the impact of DCCs on housing. I think the City of Ottawa right now is looking at a maybe doubling of some of their rates, including charging projects that are downtown for road widenings out in the suburbs, which just makes no sense at all as a growth funding model. So the conversation starting, I think one of the things we've been trying to get through to government is the housing industry is not like the auto industry, where when they want to meet with the auto manufacturers, they meet with three or four groups. The housing industry has thousands of actors, and it's a very competitive model where no one really has enough market share to do anything to the market, and there's not really one group to talk to. And it's also fundamentally complicated. Every home builder developer is a little bit different, and their capital stack's different, and the way they finance is a little bit different. So it's a really hard industry for them to interact with as well. But the biggest thing we keep saying to them is just call and talk to us. Yeah. Engage with us, because these issues are really complicated. And I don't think most of the time the way it's working is the way it's intended to work. But being such a fragmented industry and having so many different groups with different conditions across the country, it's really hard to carte blanche it without talking to all of the groups.
Well, I can say this because I'm not a developer, and that way I can't be held. Hopefully hold me back for anything because of this, but it seems like, you know, if I almost feel like various levels of government, I don't want to say intimidated is the right word, but if they just had an open door policy to have the development community come forward and say, this is what our challenges are. How can we streamline this to make it a better problem? The NDP, and maybe going back to Liberals before that, were blaming foreign buyers was why our market was going so wrong. Yet the development community has been screaming for years. It's a supply and demand issue. And we then tax foreign buyers and we don't allow foreign buyers, only to find out during COVID, when there was no foreign buyers to speak of, the market went crazy hot. And all of a sudden the NDP said, hey, I think we figured it out. I think it's a supply issue. it seems like if the various levels of government would just open that door and have these open conversations, it feels like this stuff could kind of get expedited a little bit faster than it has versus shutting the door and trying to figure it out behind closed doors. Am I correct in assuming that? Because obviously you're on the developer side. Are you guys finding that as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, big picture, in the first few years of the NDP being in power, I think you have to give them credit for probably being the most engaged with industry as a government has been on housing. And I think in the fullness of time, the new provincial housing bills, we're going to look back at them and I think they're going to be copied across the country. I think long-term, they're going to be quite successful. But there's a lot of pain in the next year or two of figuring them out and trying to understand the impacts, because it's a paradigm shift in the way that every local municipality operates. And we're in this period of almost pause right now as everyone tries to figure out how to move projects ahead. And does this go to council right now, or should I wait until the new regulations come in? And when the new regulations come in, what are my fees going to be? I don't know how anyone's underwriting a property right now, because you honestly just don't know what your cost is going to be. But absolutely, we had this period of, 10 plus years where everyone wanted to find the easy answer to the housing crisis. And I think politics have a lot to do with that. I don't think many communities wanted to hear the answer that we've been undersupplying housing in this country for decades. But that's the truth. We've delivered a pretty consistent amount of housing, regardless of population growth. And it's created this ongoing amount of housing need that grows every year and it continues to grow as housing starts fall. I mean, CMHC came out with the report, I think in 2022, that said we needed to build another 3.5 million homes on top of what we already build by 2030 to achieve any kind of, return to previous levels of affordability. And since then, the market's gotten worse. Fees and charges have increased out of control. Like, multiples above inflation. Property taxes across the country are 10%+ increases year over year. And we're just seeing this problem get worse and worse and worse. And we tried to do every possible thing but expand supply. We tried banning people, taxing people. And the industry said for a long time, you cannot tax your way to affordability. And I think the new moniker in this country is you can't tax your way into prosperity. And the only thing that's going to work to build more housing supply is to find ways to build more housing supply. And a lot of the time we need government to facilitate and advocate with this industry to do that. And there's success models. Look at CMHC's RCFI program. It created the most fruitful generation of rental housing development that we've seen since the 1960s and 1970s. And brought thousands of units into the rental market, hugely successful. West Group's done a number of projects under that program, and that should be expanded on. And it's a government program that they get paid interest, they get paid back for that. And the comparison we've been making, trying to make anyone that will listen to us in the government, is let's look at what they do with other industries. So I think our country gave out $359 billion during the COVID crisis. Needed to do that. There's $83 billion in clean tech tax credits that exist in this country. There's been nearly $27 billion go into EV battery manufacturing. But housing is getting repayable loans. And look how successful that was. So more money should be going into that. But when you look at it as an industry and you compare it to what they've done to bring Volkswagen and a battery plant in, I think at $5 million per job, they should be doing a similar scale on housing, and that's not happening. This industry doesn't get tax credits. It doesn't get, I believe the video game sector gets tax credits for employing people. And none of those things exist for the housing sector. And it's a massive part of our economy and employs a ton of people, particularly in this province.
I was talking with a developer the other day, and I'll never use their name, and they said the political challenges in this province are almost starting to surpass the geographical challenges we have in developing, where just things are getting roadblocked and new regulations and, almost one step forward, two steps back, trying to figure it out after it's been implemented. And I think there's a lot of change that has to happen to get this thing back on the road, it feels like, especially with record-setting immigration numbers coming to this country.
Yeah, I think, using my own time as an example, I put at least an equal amount of time into working with government on policy and reacting to policy as I do actually participating in our real estate development business. There's been long periods of time where I'm just not in the business. I'm just working on policy. And that's great. And it's great to be at the table, but it's not, it shouldn't be something we're spending half of our time on. And I think if we look at housing, like we look at manufacturing, you know, we're one of the largest builders in the province. And in the last 10 years, I don't think we've built two projects under the same code, be it building code, structural code, energy step code, all of the various ones combined. For all of the building we've done, every one has been a combination of different series of codes. And so how are we supposed to get to any level of efficiency when every project we build has to have a different wall assembly, different type of windows, different type of mechanical system? The industry is constantly reacting to new policy, new change. We're dealing with another brand new building code, new accessibility code coming in, new structural code coming in, ongoing changes to the energy step code. This would be like Ford having to redesign and get the F-150 re-safety certified every 200 trucks they produce. It would just never happen. But the housing industry, it's happening project by project by project. We have this ongoing change to policy, changes the way we work, changes the way the approvals happen. And every single one of them makes sense in isolation. Should we be building more efficient buildings? Yes. Should we have a more advanced structural code? Yes. But no one ever puts them all together and says, does this actually make sense?
To your point there, is Westbuild being one of the largest builders in this province, what are your thoughts on the market right now? Is there, from a project standpoint, is there things kind of getting stalled a little bit? Are you guys still fast forwarding everything, knowing that where the construction costs are, where the financing costs are, and the development world's probably obviously very challenged by a lot of this? Like, what is your, how's West Group looking at the current environment for developing right now?
Great question. So we look pretty long-term, and I think one of the things we've learned over the last number of years is the market's very fickle. And when it's on, and then it turns off, and you don't know when it turns back on again. So our approach is to get everything ready so that we can be nimble and we can react. And so I would say we're in that mode right now where we're advancing a lot of things to have them ready and trying to find the things that work. It is really challenging. There's, I think, more than ever, boardrooms in this city are having conversations about, can we get this project financed? We don't have enough pre-sales to meet our REDMA pre-sale test and get a bank to finance it because we only have 12 months to pre-sell projects in this province. And the costs are higher and the projects require more equity. And one of the biggest challenges is if you don't move ahead on that project, your building permit might expire. And then when your building permit expires, you're subject to the new fees and charges that went up 20%. And you've got to redesign your project because the energy code changed. And so now you have to go back to the drawing board, start all your drawings over again. And you end up in this spin cycle of, if I don't move forward, then I'm subject to $3, $4, $5, $6 million more costs next year. And every boardroom in the city is having that conversation right now where you can't make the numbers work. You would lose money on the project if you lower your prices. And so how do I make this project go ahead? Because next year it gets even worse. So I would say we're pretty cautious about the market right now. I mean, big picture, we're optimistic about Canada and British Columbia based on population growth being a great place to live. It's quite stable globally by comparison. But short term, it's really hard to make anything work right now. So it feels like we work 10 times as hard for, you know, a lot less to move ahead. And we're constantly having to react and try to adapt. And, you know, can we convert this into rental, and can it be a CMHC project? Or maybe that's not going to work. The details aren't clear on the new program. Not sure how much funding there's going to be. We got to go back and look at it as condo. So it's this period where it's pretty tumultuous. Things change every week. Nobody's ever watched the Bank of Canada closer. as we all try to just figure out how to make things happen. And, you know, there's companies in this city and in Toronto that are laying off staff and downsizing. And there's a lot of projects that aren't working at a time that we've never needed more housing and construction to happen. It just shouldn't be this way.
Any thoughts on interest rates? Obviously, you don't have a crystal ball, but is there any, you know, optimistic thoughts on interest rates where you guys are looking at it thinking, okay, hey, we feel things are going to move. Here's when they're going to move.
Yeah. I wish we had a better crystal ball than we do. You know, I think everything you read has a bit of a different take. There was, you know, some positive news on the job growth front that came out today, which is positive for the Canadian economy, but maybe we'll give the Bank of Canada pause that there hasn't been enough pain yet. That'd be unfortunate, but it's a moving target. And I think, you know, what we've seen is we've seen all the analysts and all the banks move out their projections for rate cuts. If there are going to be rate cuts, they're going to be small and slow, seems to be the conclusion. And, you know, on the sales side, Vancouver is a very sentiment-based real estate market. I mean, it's still, you know, you go to dinner and nobody wants to be the person that's like, oh, I bought this. And everyone goes, oh my God, in that market? I feel like that conversation drives a whole lot of our real estate market. And, you know, I think the Bank of Canada making a move just signals that, you know, hopefully there's a return to some normalcy on the interest rate environment. I don't think we're going to see what we saw over the past few years for a really long time. But everyone's just trying not to buy at the wrong time. And you know, we're definitely seeing that in pre-sale performance, in traffic in sales centers. But there's also, you know, there's pockets where success has been seen. And I think it's still a really competitive market. There's a ton of units sitting on the sidelines. There's a lot of competition in a lot of our core markets around transit. But we've also had success, you know, like our Rain project in Metrotown has had great success in that pre-sale market with a really good offering. And in that case, I use this example a lot. We were ready. So we had a project that was moving through the approval system. It was ready to launch. We had a sales center sitting there and we needed to wait until the time was right to pull the trigger. And when we did, we timed it really well. And we've had, you know, quite a good period of pre-sales there. But if we'd missed that by 3 or 4 months because of a permit delay, I don't know that I'd want to launch right now.
Yeah, good point. You talked earlier about the Inlet District, which is a 58 or 59 property assembly, which for those who are familiar with the area, it's kind of on Iowco there, right by Newport Village and Sutterbrook there. What markets is West Group excited about? Obviously, there's that one there, but is there other markets that you guys are excited about? You guys are looking into getting projects going in?
Yeah, we're really, you know, really excited about Inlet District and having a master plan there right across the street from the SkyTrain. You know, there's a lot of exciting things happening at River District. It's a constant evolution down there for us. And we've been working on that for a long time and will for a long time into the future, but really starting to see it mature with the retail offering and restaurants and, you know, the vision comes together and it's cool when we go down there. There's people that, you know, I met a few years ago that were a couple moving out of Yale Town and then you saw them walking the dog and now you see them pushing the stroller. So it's just been this, you know, growing up of that master plan that's in a really cool place. You know, we have a large four tower master plan in Surrey, right at City Center, across from City Hall, right on the SkyTrain station. That's moving through the approvals process there. We're actually quite excited. Doesn't have to have a public hearing. So that's a big benefit of the new provincial housing policy is these projects move ahead without public hearings now, it's interesting. We're starting to see those come through. And I was like, oh, I kind of enjoyed the public hearings. I don't want them back. But it was an interesting, you know, experience too. And it was exciting and didn't know it was going to happen. So it's very, I'm feeling kind of old as we go through these that I'm missing that, but not really. It's just a new experience, but we're really excited about that market as well. And you know, there's lots happening in the Lower Mainland. There's a lot happening on the housing front to be excited about.
Well, Brad, before we let you go, we know you're a busy guy and we appreciate you taking your time today. We have a six pack of lighthearted questions we ask all of our guests so we get to know you a little bit more outside of the office. Do you have a few more minutes for us?
Absolutely.
All right. First question, favorite vacation spot?
I like playing golf in Ireland, particularly Northern Ireland.
Oh.
So that would be my pick.
Now, my question is, as a wannabe golfer, how often do you get to Ireland to play? Because I struggle to get to like my local course 15 minutes from my house to play.
I've had a good run the last few years of making my way to the UK to play golf, actually almost every year.
Unreal.
But what I've found is, you know, I've traveled around to play golf with friends and we do a trip every year. And by the time you get, you know, we've done the East Coast of Canada and I've done Bandon Dunes. And you, by the time you travel to the other side of the U.S., or travel to Scotland, it's actually not that much different time-wise. And so what we've decided to do is, you know, hey, we love it here. Let's just spend our time here. So we're up in the Scottish Highlands later this year for a week as well.
Unreal. Everyone who's a golfer that's listening to this is definitely jealous. Next question up. You've unfortunately done something horribly wrong, Brad. You found yourself on death row, but you're given one more meal before it's all said and done. What meal are you having?
I, with a friend, actually, when we were in Ireland last year, we lucked into, begged our way into a restaurant in Dublin, a steakhouse called FX Buckley.
Okay.
And we called them and begged and begged and begged on our last day. And they kind of said, hey, show up at this time and we'll sneak you in. And that was one of those life-changing meals.
Wow. Wow.
Sounds good. All right, next question. Favorite band or musician?
A lot of Smashing Pumpkins the last little while.
Interesting. The world is a vampire, apparently. That was my favorite, one of my favorite bands in high school. I think I used to listen to that double album they had that came out, like, front to back over and over. This is when you had CDs and you'd get like, remember where you stabbed like the Discmans and you go for a run and you try to like run Absolutely. It so slow so it wouldn't skip. It was awesome.
You'd have to hold that thing. Yeah.
Melissa's looking at me because she's obviously younger and she's looking at me like, what's a Discman?
Well, if you were really living too, you had like the 6 CD changer so you didn't have to pop them in and out all the time, right?
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Before that, with the Walkman, you used to have to like rewind the tape to find that one part of the song that you really liked. All right, next question up, Brad. A book recommendation for our listeners, and doesn't necessarily have to be real estate related, but it can.
Oof, good question. I'm actually rereading. I read it a while ago. It's a book called The Fog of War, and it's Robert McNamara, who was Secretary of Defense for Kennedy. And for a while, actually, he was the president of Ford Motor Company, and he kind of brought statistics and analytics into the way they military plan. And it goes into, you know, real in-depth stuff on Vietnam War, Cuban Missile Crisis, etc. It's quite an interesting read. If you want to shortcut it, there's a pretty good little documentary as well.
Awesome. Good choice.
Sounds interesting. All right, next question. You are drunk at a bar. You're handed a karaoke mic. What are you singing?
Oh, boy. Just because it's probably the last one I did with a friend in Victoria, because it was fun, was Black Parade.
Oh, interesting. I guess the first time we ever had that song.
It probably should be the first time.
Well, I just like the fact that you actually did this. Most people are just guessing at a song that they would sing. You're coming from experience. You're like, when I sang.
Yeah. So,
yeah, exactly. A while ago.
More props to you. Last question up, and it's that time of the year. Brad, who's going to win the Stanley Cup?
Had a lot of fun at the Canucks game the other day, the big comeback.
Oh, amazing.
That was awesome. I got a feeling about the Rangers.
I don't think a lot of people can argue with that either. They're up 3-0 now against Carolina, and they're looking pretty good. I don't think they've lost a game yet, have they?
They haven't lost a game, and they're giving up. I mean, maybe this isn't a good thing. They're giving up like 40-plus shots a game, and Shesterkin's dominating. So
yeah, that's half the battle.
The playoffs.
Half the battle is staying healthy and having a hot goalie. I'm going to ask you a bonus 7th question here. Are the Green Bay Packers going to win the Super Bowl this year?
No, quite comfortably, I think.
So a little birdie told me that you are, now again, is it a partner? Is it a shareholder? Is it a stakeholder? But you've got some ownership in the Green Bay Packers.
I do. I certainly wouldn't call it a partnership.
Okay. Okay. How does one even become a shareholder of the Green Bay Packers? First off.
So they're community owned. Okay. So I think they've done 6 or 7 share sales in their history to raise money. Okay. They've only done 1 or 2 available to Canada. So I want to say I bought into it about 10 years ago. I think it was $300, and you it gives you the pleasure of getting invited to the annual general meeting and never collecting a cent of dividends in your life. So it's not been my best or worst investment, I guess.
But do you get the really cool share cert that you can frame and then put it on the sports wall at home when the guys are over?
I do. I do have that. I think it's been relegated to the garage, but it still exists.
Now, were you a Green Bay Packer fan before this, or when the opportunity came, you became a Green Bay Packer fan now that you're an owner?
No, I was a Brett Favre stole my heart as a kid. So
oh, okay,
yeah.
Amazing. Well, Brad, thank you so much for taking the time. How can people find out more about the amazing work that you're doing over at West Group and all your exciting projects?
Yeah, just look us up. West Group, westgroup.ca. I think that's right. Let me actually check.
That's okay. People ask me for my phone number and I can't give it to them because I'm like, I don't call myself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, westgroup.ca. Follow us on LinkedIn. Follow us on social. We try to talk about what we're doing. But yeah, lots of exciting things happening and things in the works. And we've got a great and growing team over here that we're really excited about.
Well, someone told me this about probably 3 or 4 weeks ago when I knew we were going to have you on. I've been waiting to say this. I was talking to someone and the River District came up and I referred to it as a master plan. And this individual stopped me and said, no, it's a masterpiece. So I've been sitting great on that this whole episode here, but they're referencing just how well the whole project has come together over the timeline and all of that stuff. And they're referring to it as like that's exhibit A for what people should look at when they're trying to build a master plan community. So kudos to you guys.
Thanks very much. That's always great to hear.
Excellent. Thanks so much for your time, Brad. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Brad.
Thanks.
Take care.
Thanks Bye-bye. Very much.
There you have it, folks. Our interview with Brad Jones, Senior Vice President of Development for West Group.
Yeah, great conversation. A lot of really good insight that I don't think a lot of people think about when they think about buying a home.
Well, I think there's so much talk about affordability. I think Brad really, really emphasizes it when he talks about how much sometimes per unit, like 30%,
yeah,
can be the cost of government charges. So if I'm buying a condo for $1,000 a foot or $1 million, $300,000 of that is going into the city coffers and municipal and federal or whatever it is through various costs. And I was wondering, like, if you go to Athletes Village, because you're in the village there.
Yeah.
We're not going to tell everyone your address because we don't want all the people that are showing That's up great. At your door seeing what you're doing on the weekends. But you're in the village there. I always wondered, how do you pay for a 60-foot bird? Brad right. talks about CACs. Now I know how they can pay for a 60-foot bird.
That's right. You know what I always think about is that chandelier under the Granville Street Bridge.
Wasn't that millions?
It was like, don't quote me on this, but I want to say $27 million.
$27 million for a chandelier.
Maybe 28.
See,
I could be wrong. Let's fact check that. But
yeah,
it was not cheap.
It was we'll say millions.
You know what? The conversation with Brad, it made me think there needs to be a little more transparency around this stuff.
Yeah.
Well, maybe there is and people are just not paying attention. But
well, if Adam Scalina would stop buying pieces of art for the city of Vancouver, such as the chandelier to the bridge there
we
probably wouldn't be that bad.
That's right.
Another great episode with Brad Jones there. Melissa, for all those who want to compete in this inventory-filled real estate market, it feels like, but prices are still going up. How can they get a hold of you?
You can call me 778-869-4477 or email me at melissa@vancouverrealestatepodcast.com.
And if you want to talk about the commercial side of the business, you can reach us at our Vancouver office, 604-428-5255. Let us know what you're looking for. We'll put you in touch with agents throughout the province. You can send me an email, corey@williamwright.ca, or you can visit our website, williamwright.ca, and sign up for the latest and greatest news.
All right.
All right, everyone. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with another great episode. Go Canucks, go.
Subscribe today.